listening to the Nightwork Pod. I'm Julius Caesar Macquarie and I'm an anthropologist. Nightwork Pod focuses on night workers and the lives they lead, awake and alert at night whilst the majority sleep.
This episode is based on a ContraSense podcast production. Prior to being reposted here, permission has been asked and given by the ContraSense podcast creators, Maria Martelli and Carol Pataki. During this episode, I've addressed some of the questions regarding night work, and I'm very pleased that the conversation has been at a slower pace, and therefore a rundown perhaps would be helpful to give you a flavor about this episode. So about 10 minutes, I give an intro to what it means to do use your body in anthropology and during field work at night. From about minute 10:35, it's about the conditions of night work and its embodied precarity. From minute 24, you can listen to the forms of engagement by using visual methods, for example, and a bit later, talking about night studies, night culture, and some issues regarding migration and safety. And towards the end, I talk about the present challenges and possible futures of night work. I thought to give you this rundown because the episode runs just over an hour. So enjoy and take your time and go to the minute that you wish. Hopefully you will find what you're looking for when you're asking yourself, what does it mean to be a night worker? How often do you think about the people who work at night to make night culture possible, for example? They are the people who keep things moving at night when the rest of society sleeps. So enjoy the episode. Thank you very much.
Welcome to ContraSense, a podcast exploring current issues and new research from the social sciences. I'm Maria, and together with my colleague Carol, we'll be discussing night work. This is also an episode about labor, about migrant lives, and about visual anthropology.
But first, let's take a step back and just say, we do live in very hard to understand times. It's 2021, there's still a global pandemic ongoing, together with all the social injustices it worsens, and the unfolding climate crisis. I'm not saying this to be a doomer, but just to realize that the challenges we are facing are very complex, and that we do believe sociology, anthropology, and other social sciences and humanities can help us go through the challenges facing us.
On that note, you might have noticed our podcast episodes are getting out more sparsely. Well, it's not just pandemic fatigue, it's that many of us six graduated, so some of us moved, and we're not in the same city anymore.
Plus, some of us are working, and work lives are not like student lives, as you probably know. But we're still here, slowly working on new episodes.
Quite slowly. We've recorded this episode in November 2020.
So if you want to support us, please share and react to our podcast, because that's how social media works. Leave a comment, an iTunes review, send it to your best mate.
We even have a Patreon if you feel generous.
Our guest today is Dr. Julius Caesar Macquarie. He writes on night work and embodied precarity. He founded the Night Workshop, a laboratory to research night work in cities like Budapest, Istanbul, London, Milan, Moscow, Prague, and Sofia. He intends to carry out research in Romania's larger cities, such as Bucharest, Brasov, Cluj-Napoca, Iași, and Timișoara, and continue his long-term project to make visual stories about invisible migrant night workers.
He is a STAR UBB research fellow based at the Center for Population Studies. This exploratory phase of his project investigates urban inequalities through a focus on the lived experiences of night shift workers. He wants to extend a special thanks to the Institute of Advanced Studies in Science and Technology at the Babes Bouya University for the STAR UBB generous support in this phase of his research.
After some technical difficulties with our recording, we kicked off the conversation with a discussion about the embodied aspect of our digital lives. and I asked our guest if he considers his work part of the anthropology of the body.
Well, I'm glad that you pointed out on this aspect. I mean, it's one of those points by way of introduction I would like to make. And this is one of those points is that the research that I do so far, at least as we spoke before the pandemics, it's an embodied kind of research that provides insight into a mode of laboring that is often invisible. And it's hard for the ethnographer to access through interviews and other classical journal research. And just to illustrate, in 2015, I did night ethnography in a wholesale market called New Spitalfields, which is a wholesale market of fruit, vegetables, and flowers, one of the largest in the UK. And I worked and shared the same precarious conditions as my co-participants for that entire year of research. And the embodied research focused on the bodily experience of work. Following the research, I argued that migrants' workers' subjectivity is not simply expressed through discourse, but in bodily responses to a regime of discipline that seeks to extract as much as possible, as much use from that laboring bodies, at the end of it, leaving them exhausted and spent. And there's this dialectic between this, you know, disciplinary power and the techniques of bodily management that constitutes this migrant worker subjectivity. So just to unpack that a little bit, so it's regime of discipline in terms of working hours, in terms of intensity, in terms of how bodies are exhausted by the sheer amount of hours that workers have to be up and alert during the night while rest of the society sleeps, and their role is to provide food. And this is one of the most, if you want, fundamental forms of work, providing food. So while others sleep, these workers are up and exhausted because the rhythm of work is so intense that by the end of those, on average, you have 11-hour shifts, right? But I would stay up 16 hours throughout the night because, say, there was a late delivery, and you would be expected that you stay there at no, say, overtime, extra pay, or any other incentive. You were told to stay, and those who didn't, whom I haven't met there because those who objected were seen anyway as expendable, so therefore they would be replaced. So either they left of their own accord or they were replaced by others who, because of their circumstances and conditions there, they were eager to take the place immediately of people who were in front of them. So it's often a disturbing account that I'm talking about and describing in terms of this level of precarity. So often precarity is discussed in terms of unstable income, in terms of no contractual terms. But the kind of account that I'm talking that leads into the understanding of contemporary capitalism is that it documents how this attempts to discipline these bodies and turn them into what I call bioautomatons, which are these human bodies turned into machines who work all night. And because of the intensity and requirements of that sheer difficult physical work, you could also call these bodies disposable bodies. And I guess this is disturbing in the sense that you see the level at which some bodies, you would say, are disinvested for the purpose of other bodies. And other bodies that are fostered and taken care of are these, you know, highly paid chief executives who can't afford their tight schedules to be moved at all. And so everything has to be done. So their business lunches have to be provided, you know, night cleaners have to clean the offices so that when they come in, everything is clean and for them to shift millions across borders in global cities like London. So I guess that's where this kind of embodied precariousness provides this insight into today's capitalism form of extracting as much labor from these bodies. It's one strand of my research. And then there's another one where I may go on to explain how these conditions of migration. So far we've been talking about night workers, and these night workers in global cities mostly are migrants. This is how this research links into these conditions of migrations in terms of the demands that global cities in post-industrial countries demand and rely upon. And so you have this, you know, political process in contemporary UK that leads to marginalization of this working migrants. And so in these conditions, you know, my research focuses on these worker subjectivities in relation to and these encounters between the disciplinary power and the regimes, the migration regimes. And an example of this is this hostile environment in the UK, which is Theresa May's legacy. Basically, since policies and regulations were implemented around 2016, though others argue that they started somewhere in 2012, 2013. And so the UK government's, you know, dominant political rhetoric has been focused on portraying migrants as villains, and tabloid media exacerbated it by tenfold through scaremongering. So much so that what you see is that you have these street-level bureaucrats, as Lipsky would call them, these officials and people like doctors and people like social workers, and these people would provide the street-level services. And through their everyday practices, they would implement, you know, government's regulations and impact on the everyday basis in the lives of migrants. So you see in this way how, you know, doctors and employers turn into border guards. And that's one way of also looking at how these, you know, conditions of migrations and political processes affect the lives, the everyday lives of these migrants, whom I argue that in the case of night workers, they are mostly invisible. You get a night worker who is, as I mentioned earlier, exhausted and spent, and the last thing they need or they want is to learn a new language, because without having access to language, it's very difficult to access a better working place on better contract. You know, the last thing you want to do is to learn English language or any other language. So that's, in a sense, this other strand in my work.
Yes, I think you went in all the many directions that your work tries to touch on. That is, of course, this work that happens at night, the precarity, the migration, the question of language, and the question of bodies. And what I really found fascinating about your work was, of course, this focus on the body that and on the embodiment that can also be seen, because you also do visual anthropology, but also just by how much you stayed and worked there. And I wanted to ask you if you could say again how long you worked there. And I remember from one of your films, you said you lost weight, and what were the effects on your body?
Yes, thank you. So I did this night ethnography for 1 year, as I mentioned earlier, and 8 months of that year, roughly speaking, 8 months, I was working 6 nights per week in this market, and I was a loader, loading fruits and vegetables for grocery store owners who would come to the market from midnight onwards, and they would stay there 3-4 hours, load their trucks, go back, load the shelves, be ready for morning customers with fresh and fruits and vegetables. And as part of my 8 months there, I was embedded into this market, and I spent those hours of serving customers very highly intensive rhythm. And that rhythm, it impacted in my body, in my sleep, on my emotional being. So firstly, I gradually noticed how I lost weight, and I've never identified it, whether that was a combination, combining these factors of very intense. So when I say intense, I mean in a night, being that I wasn't an experienced worker who could move faster, who could carry. I mean, my body is not, you know, is not equipped to lift up like my colleagues did 2-3 tons. So in one night, you would lift up 2-3 tons on your body. I would perhaps do somewhere like 500 kilos and lifting up all these products and setting them up on a pallet, putting them on the truck and so on. And because of the intensive style of work, coupled with the fact that I started to sleep less and less in the day. So we have it clear. As a night worker, you sleep in the day and you can kiss goodbye your 8-7 hours or 10 hours, depending on what you need. These physiological rhythms, they change as a night worker because the circadian rhythms have a peak and a trough. And then you have the nadir point, which is the lowest part, the lowest point in this 24-hour physiological clock. And in my case, this physiological point, which was the lowest, was somewhere around between 4 and 6. And between 4 and 6, I had customers and I still have to be up and serve and be alert and pay attention to their orders and be careful and be fast enough. But I had moments when my knees would drop. Literally, I could not control my knees. And on a couple of occasions, there was this particular customer I remember who came and he both on both occasions, I just completely, as if you'd lose your consciousness for 2-3 seconds, my knees would drop. And I've learned later that what my body does at that low point is that it wants to lay down. It doesn't want to be vertical. And as opposed to the zenith of the 24-hour clock, where you peak, you're performing at your best. Nadir point is when you are at the lowest and you need to lie down and your body needs to rest. Well, I had no choice but to be up. So that this customer is asking, you know, are you okay? What's happening? Because he noticed that somehow I wasn't there. And so you have that experience in the night. And then when you travel 1 or 2 hours to go home, which is London being a global city with long hours of commuting, you have to change so many transports and so on. By the time you get home, I would have my meal, which I can't quite tell whether it was breakfast or dinner or, you know, midday for me, it was, you know, cereals and breakfast, and I couldn't wait to get back to sleep. But even that sleep wasn't enough because the body was so exhausted, never recovered on that one night off, because at the market, you'd only have Sunday night off. The rest of the night, you had to be there. So then the body would enter into, on one hand, into a mode, which is what I mentioned earlier, this body management, where it readjusts to this night rhythm at the expense of losing your sleep hours. And gradually, I've lost about 14 kilos. And I was sleeping on average about 5 hours. But that means I would have gone for, say, 11 to 16 hour shift on just 2 or 3 hours of sleep in the day. Add to it the fact that you sleep in the day when, you know, people around you are active. Add the fact that you have the daylight. And you know, there's many components feeding to this new way of living. And if your body is not adjusting well, you're then exhausting your body and you start feeling the effects on it. And they are very unpleasant. But before I go into the unpleasantness, I think what I experienced during that year was the social isolation side of doing this work. And this social isolation means that you are not able to join people in the evening, or you're not able to join people for a Christmas party. You're not able to join even for a simple evening dinner, as I was sharing accommodation for other people. And on my way out, I see these friends playing cards and waiting for their, you know, food to be ready and eat. And I had to go to work. And it was the first time when I felt like I really wanted to throw that bike and not go to work and just sit with them, play cards and have my evening meal. But that would have been kiss goodbye my place at the market. As I mentioned earlier, you're expendable. You don't turn up like it happened once. My body was so exhausted that I simply could not turn up. I had a sickness note from my doctor. I went back to the market and I showed that to the manager. He looked at it for a couple of seconds. He threw in the paper as if like, How dare you come to me and tell me that you couldn't come to work? I'm not interested in this. And the reaction of my colleagues was really striking here, because I said, look, I have a 7 days sick note. And they look at it and they say, what do you mean sick? I mean, what? Are you talking about AIDS here? That's not sick. I mean, you made that on the computer, right? It's not a sick note. And why it was striking is that I realized that people who work at this market have never seen a sick note in their lives. And they were never even conceiving that you could actually turn and say, I have a sick note. By law, I'm entitled to it. And therefore, I should be able to stay at home and not being sort of sanctioned, if you want, or having my job loss. And I guess that was striking in that sense. So then you have this physical exhaustion going on to this unpleasantness. And then you have the social dimension, the social isolation effect, that after 8 months, coming to, I guess it was somewhere around April, May, when I felt so quite depressed, I would say. I pushed my body, I pushed my boundaries, I pushed my limits to a point where I said, I have to be careful, because when you're in the field, you know, you supervise as much supervision you can get and guidance on it. You are there in the field and you're the one who has to decide to up to which point you can go, whatever intensity you can take emotionally, physically, psychologically. And I guess it was a point where I had to decide when to stop doing this kind of night ethnography in terms of participant observation, which is what I've been describing so far. I don't know if that answers.
It answers a lot. I mean, there is so much to think about here, especially the knowledge that you were able to access, let's say, because you accessed it with your own experience and your own body. And there are all these things you could have not felt or known just through interviews or other kind of research. And then there's, of course, this separation that there is still between you and your work colleagues, because for you, this was research and you could get out of it while they couldn't.
Yes. In that sense, you could say I was privileged to exit that kind of life. But I guess while we point this out, what I have been doing since I exited the field site in 2015, I have been committed to visibilizing this world, which is invisible to many day people. So we're talking about a day labor system. So we have this daytime labor system designed to include somehow night shift. What I think it's causing, or rather further invisibilizes the night shift workers and their lives from the rest of the mainstream society. And I guess this committed type of ethnography that I'm talking here about is that it continues long after you left the field site. And in my case, this is about the ways that I found to engage mixed audiences with films. So you know about the short film trilogy in which I sort of tried to include various aspects of night work, and starting with Invisible Lives, this brainchild of a filmmaker and anthropologist who tried to capture both the lives who are up, so these Romanian night workers working in London, but at the same time give a feel about London. So it's quite picturesque in a sense. But as we move on to Nocturnal Lives, which was filmed and includes sequences of me talking about the fieldwork aside the words and experiences of three of my co-workers, I start to go in depth into what it is like to lead a nocturnal life and be a day sleeper. And I guess the Night Shift Spitfields, the third one, is as short as it is, it packs in it elements of homelessness, elements of physical exhaustion, elements of the night shift, which is which is this mode of living that is stretching your being in so many directions. And I guess the bottom line in this film is that no matter how many times this protagonist, Ali, is trying to escape this environment because he's becoming a sort of a burden for him, he's still trapped in it, because you also have to, at some point, I supported him with in this moment of homelessness, where his whole family experiences this situation in which he has to sort of drop work for 2 nights and then deal with homelessness, and after 3 nights and his family move into a temporary accommodation. So he has to sort of separate himself between the two, and then eventually going back into, and as soon as a homelessness episode is finished, he's back into work continuing. So which means you have no window to breathe and sort of try and understand what's been happening. And I guess this is the visual component of my research. So I guess for me, visual anthropology is a little bit too much to say that I do visual anthropology as such. It's more like I use digital methods, and they don't replace face-to-face interactions in my case, at least up to now, up to the pandemic times, but they complement in a way, and they compensate for the lack of opportunities, if you want, to carry out in face-to-face fieldwork. So I guess in these conditions, digital methods, we're relying more and more on it. And using audiovisual methods in anthropological studies brings new possibilities for engagement with the critical public. And this is what the short film trilogy is supposed to do, to engage those mixed audiences that include NGOs, activists, include the academics, include the critical public at large, with topics that are very difficult to digest sometimes from, you know, a journal article. So one reason that, you know, could be perhaps taken out of it is that there's a combined methodological approach that symbolizes this close relationship between the visual and the touches. That's, you know, touch senses. That's what I've been trying to do.
Yes, I really like that. I think what you said, of course, is important regarding the visual part of it, that it makes it more accessible. But also what I think it does is just mediates another kind of knowledge, you know, knowledge about this work, knowledge about these people that do this work and what it feels like, because you can actually hear them tell their own stories. And it is also very fitting to, you know, signal how embodied this work is and how it happens in this context and in these very particular lives.
Yeah, I'm glad that you found it and resonate in this way, because the idea is that we're surrounded by images. As Pink says, images are everywhere, and the power of the image offers that space for interpretation and multiple meanings, and, you know, as this fascinating endings. And unlike other methods, you know, the visual can allow for that space. And there's this core message that, you know, we experience in the way the world surrounds us and with bodies and through senses. And at the same time, we use our eyes to receive and transmit this message. And the message is basically this window, if you want to use a window into reality documented through research. You know, before a camera can capture it, you know, you have to go in the field, you have to sort of build up those relationships and engage with these people. And I think that one of the advantages of using visual as opposed to, say, interviews is that I found myself engaging with people while showing photos, and these people were more like readily to participate in this photo shoot rather than give an interview, and I found that a great advantage. So that's also important to bear in mind when you decide whether you want to complement classical research methods with say audiovisual recordings. So then later you can reap the rewards of having this possibility of presenting and engaging audiences visually long after you left the field site.
I wanted to say that that's a very interesting insight in the way to do research, and understand that part of your choice was to make it more available to a larger public. What I was wondering, maybe I don't actually have a good segue for it, but I was wondering why this specific type of night work. I understood from the text at some point, I think you kind of compared the labor from the Spitfield markets, the night work that happens directly in the City of London or its surrounding area, and you compare it to the work in the rest of the south of England. And you talk about care work, caretakers and nurses, which also have night shift, and a big part of their labor happens during the night. And I was wondering if you make a clear distinction between this kind of physical, let's call it physical, in quotation marks, labor that happens in places such as the Spitfield markets, and the type of, maybe let's say, more of an emotional labor that happens with nurses, caretakers, and maybe others.
I see. I understand the question now. Thank you. I guess the approach, it's something that it's sort of revealed to me, if you want, following the fieldwork. So initially when I went in with this, you know, prepared and say theoretically armed with this concept, solidarity and competition. And I was interested in how groups engage and support one another and what sort of forms of solidarities are there. And I came to understand that the possibilities for solidarity are very fragile in this context. The fact is that they are so spent that anything else becomes secondary in terms of collective action of the workers. And I guess this is sort of like how the field work revealed to me, rather than what I went in to find out and explore. That's where the focus was on this particular form of labor. But as Maria was also saying earlier, it's still a sensorial experience. Even if you talk about people being up at night in call centers, that's also a physical experience, if you want, because you still have to be up at night. The call centers in India basically serve customers from, say, Australia or the North Americas, and they still sort of experience that, you know, if you want, hysteresis effect. It's a different sort of like before, because they engage with these customers who they never meet really the other you know, part of the world, and because of this time zone, and because of never actually engaging socially with these people with whom they form some sort of relationships over time, they experience this hysteresis effect. So then there's another form of labor there which is affected. I mean, so in a sense, what I'm saying is that all night workers are subject to precarity, whether you talk about leaving carers, whether you talk about cleaners, and there's a certain element of precarity insofar as they need to stay alert during the hours when human bodies are supposed to rest. And so, but this precarity is further aggravated in the case of migrants. I'm not saying there are no migrants in the care or nursing. It's quite the opposite. You know, there's a high percentage of migrants serving. And as the pandemic has shown, many migrants have been up and serving, you know, whether it's a bus driver or whether it's a nurse or cleaner in a hospital, you know, they are up and providing those services. And I guess what we want to see is more awareness and acknowledgement, not just for the essential frontline workers, but on a grander scale, you know, when society sleeps, who remains awake, right? So we want to know more about that, and hence why I'm focusing more on this lower level of precarity, because this is what I guess it's really important to point out, that this kind of research on precarity and focusing on night work provides this term for politics that demonstrates the existence of different layers of precarity within the labor system. And I tried to explain that this day labor system includes the night shift, as opposed to having night shift on its own considered, and the night workers considered as having this opposite, living on opposite rhythms to the rest of the society. You get this night shift included into a labor system which has not accommodated the needs of these night shift workers. And that's how you further invisibilize night workers. And another way is that because for researchers is a difficult way of accessing, that there's very little written, even in the emerging field of night studies, for example, you know, these night studies are not so useful in basically getting insight, in-depth insight into the level of precarity of night workers. And I guess this is where you have this intersection between, because you happen to work at night and be a migrant and do a manual low, somewhat unfairly called low-skill job, you basically experience probably one of the lowest levels of layers of precarity. Yeah. So then this precarity is aggravated in the case of migrants who are likely to accept these skilled jobs more than locals would on precarious working terms, right?
Yeah, I just want to say thank you for the explanation, and that makes a lot of sense. I understand the difference between the different types of night works.
I was thinking about, I didn't know there was this separate field called night studies. That's interesting. Maybe you could say something more about that. And after that, I was thinking maybe, yes, we could focus on how night work relates to migration, because of course many of these night workers are migrants, especially I think in London where you researched, but I imagine this must not be true everywhere. In Romania, for example, I do not know if there are so many of them are migrants.
I see. So there's quite a few points that you're raising there. So let's try and do them one by one. So the first one is the emerging field of night studies, which focuses, it comes from a urban studies approach. And so you have studies who have been, or researchers have been interested in the nightlife aspects, interested in governance aspects. So you have the, you know, policies around nighttime space, darkness, security. What I found is that somehow the focus on night work compared to, say, nightlife workers, it's somewhat limited in the sense that I see the effort on the cultural aspects, on sort of reviving the cultural, the night culture, to most affected, say, work sectors are hospitality and accommodation in the UK. So overall, the workforce is somewhere like 3.2 million of workers doing night shifts or evenings, some sort of type of unsociable hours of work stretching somewhere between evening, late evening and early into the night. Some would go up to 16 hours of work. So you get these sectors in hospital and accommodation that have been suffering the most during the pandemic, because many have been laid off and furloughed and some were left at their own device because the government doesn't want to support them. And this is where these categories of essential and non-essential have been somewhat unhelpful, because you get the frontline workers celebrated and you get the so-called non-essential in hospitality and accommodation. There are sort of disregarded, if you want, and left at their own device to make ends meet. And not only that, but in the UK context, you have Rishi Sunak, I think is his name, the governor, who tells, you know, say, Sopranos, for example, who have invested 15, 16 years of their lives to retrain, basically. Yeah. So you're now telling the artists, you're telling the creatives to suddenly just turn around and do some job, because basically many independent artists and creators have been suffering during the pandemic. And so you see this categorizing, which is very unhelpful. And in particularly when you talk about, certain work sectors who are relying heavily on migrants. So you're talking around 18 to somewhere between 18 to 25% of foreign born in the UK who are support this infrastructure in transport, communication. As I mentioned earlier, cleaners in night hospitals, you know, night cleaners, offices, and so on, who basically have been there before the pandemic, they're there during the pandemic, and will continue long after the pandemic, once we see it through. And so you have many sectors who have been which have been left out of this newly emerging night studies who look at the night phenomena, if you want, more into the aspects of safety and cultural life than into aspects of work. As if you could have night culture and nightlife without night work. Because for someone to have fun, others have to be up and alert to work and provide that fun. And that's feeding into, you know, social strata in the sense that, you know, some bodies are fostered and taken care of and are able to enjoy this night life and night culture and night museums and you name it, who are up, which are up and open, but not on their own. They are supported by a huge number of, you know, of night workers who provide these services. So basically these are the backstage workers, if you want, and what I've been trying to do is to sort of visibilize these aspects by focusing on night work and by, if you want, putting some faces onto this invisible lives and raising some voices, because these voices seem to be further and further shut down or attempted to anyway. It's quite unpleasant to hear that for someone to enjoy their nightlife, you have others who have to spend the nights and provide that service. And it's not as if to say is that there's something basically wrong in this. It's just that those who are up and alert providing the services, they should have access to decent working conditions. They should be treated accordingly and not as expendable as they are. And so you talk about terms and conditions of work. You're talking about being paid overtime if they have to stay up overtime, being considered their way to work and back for the transport that they have to use in the night hours. You have elements of safety, as we know, dark and darkness is perceived as a much more dangerous space, and therefore we should consider these elements. But often, more often than not, they're not considered, and they're expected to be met by the individuals themselves. You're not investing in this workforce, as I found, this night workforce, unless you're talking about the stockbroker. So London Stock Exchange, for example, you have people I spoke to, and they're there because they want to learn the Asian market, for example. They're not there because they are pushed to be up and do the trading at night. So there's a difference here, and it's highlighted by this working conditions. So when it comes to, you know, sustainable development goals agenda of the UN 2030, you have goal number 8, which states very clearly in terms of economic growth and decent working conditions what the standards should be in terms of working hours and salary and conditions. And night market, which is where I found it appalling in terms of working conditions. You had no place to sit and have your meal. If you're lucky, you had a 15 minutes break. Otherwise, you'd have had to carry on until the customers or the wave of customers left. You even had to report going to toilet. There's different layers here, and I think these voices need to be heard, and their faces need to be seen. So somehow they enter into this mainstream societies and the eyes and minds of the people that often function in the day, as opposed to people who work at night.
I think we could there could be a whole discussion about the part in which you talked about the darkness and which is visible in one of your movies, if not in all of them. Actually, I think in all the three short films, about the idea of safety in the darkness, and it's an aspect that they people don't actually think about or notice maybe on Friday nights, I guess, or something like that. But I would like to move towards a different point. I understand that you would like to start research in Romania cities and maybe the night work in Romania. As you said previously, there are different layers of night work in general. But how would it be compared, maybe, if you thought about this already, work of a migrant in a foreign country, such as the migrants from everywhere in the world in London, compared to the night work here at the periphery of capitalism?
I think I mentioned at the beginning that as a Stau Bebe fellow, I began on sort of an exploratory phase of doing research at night in so-called siliconized smart cities, Romanian cities, you know, and sort of like research sites. You can think of larger cities like Bucharest, Brasov, Cluj-Napoca, Iași. You know, these are the kind of cities where you have IT industries sort of focused and functioning for quite a few years. And I thought that it would be good to explore. But given this, you know, how COVID pandemic, you know, affected the way we function and we carry out research, we also perhaps, if not going through a global economic recession, and you know, researching and in terms of emerging inequalities is more pertinent, and particularly in regions which attract migrants. And my presumption is that, as we've noticed, you know, for example, seasonal workers, you know, whether you have the borders closed or not, if the UK or Germany needs fruit pickers, somehow those borders are open again. Surprise, surprise. So you have this segment of migrants that the way they used to work before, in the sense of, you know, going and picking fruits and vegetables in other countries, so from Romania to the UK or Germany, the work as they knew it continues for them, right? While as others, the work they knew it stopped because of the pandemic. And I guess these are challenges in at both ends, in a sense. So, you know, this exploratory phase of this research is sort of like on a stop, if you want. At this stage, I can't say much about this at this point, but I'm hoping that once that we sort of come out of the way that sort of going in and out of lockdowns and uncertainties, I could move on and explore and perhaps make some connections between the heartland of capitalism and the areas at its periphery, in that sense that perhaps make some links between the research and the way migrants experience night work in places like London, or perhaps smaller cities, so you have smaller capitals and the cities and like Cluj. So the idea is to perhaps not so much make a comparative study, but as I mentioned earlier, well, at least I haven't come across, but make some of these voices and louder, if they are, in terms of which migrants are and what experiences they have in working in the smart cities, yeah? And as I mentioned earlier, also you have these services, manual low-skilled workers who provide these services and support this infrastructure, growing infrastructure, if you want, in this so-called siliconized Romanian cities, the smart cities that attract migrants.
I was thinking, this was something that actually got stuck in my head when I was watching your movies. Let's call them movies for now, just shortly, really short films. Some of the things the people said, and also what you said like a few minutes ago regarding how this work should be regulated. And I remembered that some people said that working at night was like living in a different world, and that it's really tough on your body. And someone said they can't smile during the day anymore. And someone else kept saying, day sleep is not the same as night sleep. So I was thinking, of course it would help if this night work would be regulated, but must we really work at nights? I think this is the question I'm thinking about. Is this really, can we not imagine a world in which some people are not made to be working this work that is really alienating and tough on their bodies in itself?
I guess that's a very good question, but I don't see myself giving a full answer to it. What I can do is perhaps make reference to some of the important literature by art critic and historian John Crary, who wrote this book called 24/7 Ends of Sleep. And he makes reference to 18th century painter, I think it's Joseph Wright, who depicts the lives of the workers as early as 18th century, somewhere about. And he describes these paintings which show that women and children were up and working by the candlelight. And so what actually this says is that this sort of today's capitalism at an advanced stage from where it sort of started in that period when you had the cotton mills houses and the British countryside as depicted by Joseph Wright in his paintings. And I guess, can we envision today's capitalism without productivity, night productivity, when the rhythm, if you want, is to open up to 24/7. The societies have been moving in that direction for a few centuries now, and it's hard to imagine that this will decelerate in a way and revert from it when, and not only that, the 24/7 global cities have been functioning in this rhythm going back to the time when nocturnalization began with you know, electric light and big cities like London, Paris, and Berlin. It's hard to imagine that cities would decelerate. What's more worrying is that a greater number of people involved in night work experience more and more unfair, indecent working conditions while this rhythm expands. It's sort of an incessant rhythm of 24/7 of productivity and consumption that happens, as I mentioned earlier, at the expense of somebody, a disinvestment, if you want, in biopower in Foucauldian terms, if you want, explaining how this investment happens at the expense of disinvestment, so some bodies for other bodies, if you know what I mean. So there's a cost involved there, and this cost is experienced in ways that are described in the literature by Sharma, for example, who calls this expendable bodies. You have Tanya Lee, who calls them disposable lives. Precariousness, it's at a depth of a magnitude that, not that it didn't exist, but I think it's magnified by several degrees when you are migrant night workers in a global city, for example.
Okay, so we cannot imagine having capitalism without night work. But can we imagine something other than capitalism that also doesn't include night work?
Something of the kind. What do you have in mind here when you ask this question?
What might come after capitalism?
I mean, a sort of post-capitalism. I wouldn't want to perhaps go into that direction, because I see it as so consuming the way it is now, and it's hard for me to imagine something as sort of an after. Perhaps also because my focus has not been so much into exploring the after. You know, when you embed it into this kind of research, is quite consuming for the researcher as well. And I guess if I were to answer this question, then I would have to bring back the body into the discussion. I can only talk in this terms of sort of circadian and post-circadian capitalism. What I've been talking about so far, it's a way of talking in respect and disrespect to the physiological rhythms that capitalism has sort of went from one phase, that circadian phase, where it had some respect for the bodies and human life, in the sense that previous generations, they would be, you know, their time would be sort of, if you want, structured into, you know, education, work, retirement. So you had some structure, some idea of what your life would look like. And you would have this respect in terms of awake and sleepness, in terms of work and rest, which in this post-circadian, if you want, I don't know if we can call it post-capitalism era, but in this post-circadian capitalist sort of phase, there's no respect for that. There, you can look at in terms of labor, of the flexicurity, you know, these terms which expect that you would ever flexible, you're ready to move, you're ready to migrate, you're ready to, you have to be there at flexible hours on insecure work contracts, and your body, going back to this bodily experience, completely disrespected. So the degrees of embodied precariousness in this post-circadian capitalist era is magnified by several degrees. And I guess one of the things that we haven't been talking much is the way that workers use a bodily kind of knowledge to survive the night and to perform. On one hand, in this post-industrial countries, it's on one hand, it's sort of night work, it's celebrated. But at the same time, night workers are considered expendable. I doubt that there is any going back in the sense of the times when there were some respect for these circadian rhythms, where there was no interference between the private and the public life. I think at the moment where we experience this, there's this invasive, if you want, invasive encroachment on the private sphere of the worker, and there's no time for social family life, if you want. There's no time for rest. There's only time to produce and consume, and therefore the worker needs to be more flexible than ever, and he needs to provide this bodily labor. So the worker's bodily capital is a threat in a way, because what I've been talking about in terms of precariousness at the night market is that this bodily capital is exhausted, is running out. And the worker's possibilities to collectively organize and demand their rights and to collectively perhaps envisage a new way or another life for them, it's low, because that's a secondary concern in terms of their survival. So that bodily knowledge that I introduced is that the knowledge that these workers have in terms of performing, bodily performance and bodily discourse, it's all concentrated on surviving this night shift, as opposed to expand in terms of the social relations, in terms of cooperation, which some studies out there by Richard Sennett shows that in terms of cooperation, that can also be established in sort of bodily terms, in terms of physical labor. When you look at the Craftsman, the book that he wrote on Craftsman, and how he explores capabilities of cooperation and socialities among these kind of workers. But when you're a migrant and you work in highly precarious environments and you have to be there 6 nights a week, be happy that you have a few hours that you spend with a partner or family on the only day off, you can't think of these forms of cooperation or show some solidarity. I mean, there's this sort of insight that I'm absorbed by, in a way. The way that Richard Sennett puts it is that people, they work together, but not with one another. And I think this sums up very well where cooperation breaks and possibilities for solidarity are more and more fragile in this highly precarious environment. For the researcher, it's also very difficult, I would say, to explore this side unless you have the opportunity, as I did, to be embedded in that field for such long period, because nowadays, with so little money for research or rather long ethnographic research, you think in blitz field work or none because of the pandemic conditions. So then you're relying on online digital methods that we've been talking about.
Yes, it was, it made sense. It makes a lot of sense what you're saying, although it's not so good to hear, but it's coherent.
It's a bit depressing, isn't it? Yeah, you know, it's often I had this, you know, in moments of exhaustion, as I mentioned, when you have this point where you have to decide whether you can go ahead, whether you know, it's like, perhaps I should have researched nightlife. At least I would have gone into a club and have some good fun while I was researching. But no, I took this highly precarious field, if you want, and doing research. But nevertheless, it's been very rewarding. And I guess there's a Buddhist saying that comes to mind: no mud. No lotus. And I guess what I could add to that is that the lotus is in the mud. And in terms of some of my peers, they said, you know, why do this research? Why is someone suffering? And I guess there's no blooming without suffering. And that's my attempt to turn it into a positive note.
I was actually thinking of adding something a bit defeatist in the end, actually. I can think of a moment in our, I don't know, common history since the beginning of agricultural production in which night work was not somehow necessary. I just feel like in the modern times it just has been exacerbated to a point in which, well, you know yourself. I don't even know how to express it in words. I don't work nights that often to actually think about how important the impact of night work is for the good working of the modern consumerist capitalist system as we know it and in the system in which we actually live in, and think each and every one of us have benefited from the night work of others, unfortunately. There is no escaping from it.
What my fear is because we have examples. I think we can look around us, and we don't necessarily need to speak strictly of night work. We can, I mean, what amazes me lately is because of this sort of abundance, if you want, of platforms and online methods. I sometimes get email from HR at 11 p.m. and could be in some other countries 9 or 10 or plus 10 hours. So you get this sort of intrusion, if you want, you know, with emailing and being on so many different platforms to communicate. I guess if not night work, sort of if you were to, I mean, we anecdotally here we sort of like speculating that perhaps not strictly speaking in terms of night work, but the work day, if you want, stretches slowly and gradually towards evening and even late night in terms of sort of being available. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
24/7 available, and it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be structured by this 10 p.m., 10, 6 a.m., or, you know, this strictly speaking night shift.
Yeah, I was wondering that it's simply a part of globalization, and you have to be available to the person on the other side of the planet, literally, from the communications industry, I would say, the communication economy, you literally have to talk with people on the other side of the planet, and they
they might be more important than yourself, so you have to stay up for them, not them for yourself. So
kind of like that, yes.
I guess that's what I would have to add here, and I believe we should finish slowly. If you have any ending words, or if you already said them, I know, maybe finish on a more positive note, I guess.
I guess more to do with the kind of research that I've been doing. One thought that I have is we're talking about this message, you know, and the kind of committed ethnography that I have been engaging with. So this kind of engaged way of visibilizing night work, putting out messages for the people in the backstage, and I guess this message, as I mentioned, is this window into reality that is documented through research, and we shouldn't underestimate the advantage of digital methods to use, you know, because you're, as a researcher, you enter the field, your camera is capturing you, you're recording, you know, there's lives out there, and they stay outside of the film, and they represent it to an audience and the lives long after the researchers left the film, and they're important. So I guess I'd like to close with the words of sociologist of migration and ethnic studies, Marco Martiniello, who argues that mainstream research approaches to migration they're too often policy driven, and I think it's important that to encourage researchers using visual methods in migration studies. And that's because in complex way, if you want, it's a set of very intricate issues, social issues, and migration I'm talking here, right? So it's a set of this, you know, intricate social issues, and it's one that's forming total, you know, social phenomenon that we call migration. I think visual methods have a big say in this growing field of migration. And in terms of, you know, night work with this invisible lives spent at night and post-industrial societies, it's important to understand that, you know, when society sleeps, they are awake. They are there to, with the health or economic crisis, they continue providing and supporting this infrastructure. And it's important that we consider that night work, it's not included in the day. Night work stands on its own as part of a labor system which is more inclusive. And when I say inclusive, I mean inclusive of these lives spent at night while society sleeps.
Thank you. Thank you for all of the talk. It was really interesting. And I think it's like you said, it's so often overlooked, and yet it is so essential, this night work. And it's really good to talk about it and to bring it forth, and also to have this visual. Well, we don't have the visual here, but to know that there are your films can be viewed, and it really brings forth a different way of engaging and knowing this. Thank you for listening to ContraSense. Today's guest was Dr. Julius Caesar McGuire. This episode was produced by Maria Encaro. Opening and closing soundtrack by Kind Studios. Recorded in our homes.
If you liked the episode, you can support us by donating to our Patreon. You'll find the link below. More about us on our Facebook page, and you can listen to us on SoundCloud, YouTube, iTunes, and Spotify. We're looking forward to your feedback and questions at ContraSense@protonmail.com.